Hey everyone, this is Cameron from Renegade Animation on renegadepopculture.com. If you like what we do, please give us a like, a follow, and a rating on Apple Podcast or wherever you listen to us. Also, make sure to share our episodes around. If you can, consider supporting our Patreon. That way, we can keep doing what we love, and that's talking about the amazing and vibrant world of animation. And now, on with the show.
What's going on, everyone? Welcome to another episode of Renegade Animation on the Renegade Pop Culture Podcast Network. My name is Mike. I'll be your host this evening. Joining me, as always, is the animation guru himself, Cameron.
Howdy, howdy.
And today's episode is our fourth year covering the New York International Children's Film Festival. We have a bunch of films to talk about. These titles include Kensuke's Kingdom, The Concierge, Chicken for Linda, Sirocco, and The Kingdom of Winds, and, of course, Robot Dreams. But before we get into the weeds, Cameron, how would you generally describe this year's festival?
I think this festival had a very strong rollout of films. Definitely no Netflix or Disney screenings here, unlike in 2021, where they had the Raya and the Last Dragon screening there. But I don't go to these festivals just to see the big stuff early. I go to festivals like this and Animation as Film for the overseas productions. While not as tightly wound as Animation as Film with its lineup, this is still a pretty good alternative if you can't go to California and, you know, partake in Animation as Film, because this is the next best thing. I would say Animation First was also pretty good, but they keep being a hassle to try and contact for screener access, because I would love to talk about the films that they show there.
I understand, because even though I don't live in the city, I'm about 4.5 hours away by train. It's a lot. And New York is one of the most expensive cities to even visit. And plus, with film festivals being pretty much all day nonstop for a handful of days, I understand they're not always the easiest for those who can't exactly travel. But I'm glad that we were able to get screeners for these movies, because while not all of them were all that memorable, the majority of them showcased some of the best animation from overseas.
The thing about this festival is I actually very much enjoyed the main films that I watched. The only one I found underwhelming were more quote-unquote underwhelming, because they were not aimed at me. They were aimed at very little kids. But even then, for those very little kids, you need to give them something to start with. You can't just be like, hey, we're going to sit down my three-year-old and watch Watership Down. Start them out in the very deep end. You need stuff like the new Puffin' Rock animated film, or the new Donya film, The Great White North, which was very cute. And it also did a few things I did like, for example, including having multiple languages and cultures talked about in one movie. But again, those are for very small kids. Not every kid is going to want to jump into the deep end. You need stuff like Rosa and the Stone Troll, Puffin' Rock and the New Friends, or Donya and the Great White North. Because sometimes they might not want to start with some of these other things, like Kensuke's Kingdom, where I've been waiting for this movie for years. I saw the trailer pitch for it. The animation looked incredible. Like, it's good. The adaptation of the book of the same name by Michael Morpurgo, the adaptation is directed by Neil Boyle and Kirk Hendry, about a young boy who has swept off his family's boat and washes ashore with his dog on an island. And he meets an old Japanese man who has been protecting these orangutans in the nature of that land from people like poachers and such. Like, that's not the easiest one to jump into for kids. Or no. At least, I don't think it would be the first film I would show.
This one might be a bit on the heavy side, at least, like, especially when you learn more about Kensuke's backstory. That would probably be more for, I guess, preteens or maybe teenagers, but at least animation-wise, this one I thought was really well done. I like the design of the human characters. I love the backgrounds and the water in like the first, I guess, half hour.
It's a mix of traditional 2D animation, CGI used when they need to, like with the water. Something that I think people will either love or hate, the photo edited realistic backgrounds. Like some of them are, it's like a combination of 2D elements with photorealistic backgrounds. Very much like how the old Disney Jungle Book looked, where, like that first scene with the waterfall and such.
Oh, yep.
Where it's like that waterfall was not animated in a traditional sense. It was probably like some 2D background put around the footage of a real life waterfall. I didn't mind it. It got a little distracting at points just because you can tell how these are just edited photos, which is not bad. 2D animation is already a painstaking process. I can understand them doing this to save on a production to focus on the actual like stuff that needed it, like the writing, the storytelling, the animation on the characters that we're going to be seeing on screen at all times. And the bond between Michael and Kintsugi is very heartwarming because Michael, while not the most interesting lead character, starts out a bit of a brat, does start to learn about how he needs to cherish the people he's with and learn about the connection between man and nature. And the sequence when we learn about Kintsugi's backstory of where he was a sailor during World War II, the tragic loss of his family when, what we dropped in Nagasaki back in that time period.
Yep.
And it's all done in this beautiful Japanese ink art style. And the moment where you see the ink blot drop from the head of the brush onto the paper to symbolize and indicate the bomb, so creative. I love that storytelling decision. The only thing I would say is that maybe it takes a little too long to get to the bond between Michael and Kintsugi because we spend a lot of time on the boat and then a lot of time of Michael having to put two and two together and realize he has to start surviving and learning about how to work around his predicament with his dog. And I will say, if people are like, oh, wow, Cillian Murphy and Sally Hawkins are in this. I can't wait to see this movie for that. Don't come to see the movie because of Cillian Murphy and Sally Hawkins. Come see this movie for Ken Watanabe and Aaron McGregor. They are the ones who carry this movie with their friendship and performances. And I say this because Cillian Murphy and Sally Hawkins don't particularly have big roles within this movie. They show up at the very beginning and then vanish until the very end, which is kind of funny because the original book has Michael meeting Kintsugi's son, who was actually alive, instead of just leaving it at, oh, they died during the bomb.
The movie actually kind of makes his backstory even more traumatic because we don't get to see what happens in the epilogue.
Exactly. It ends right when Michael reunites with his family and Kintsugi goes back into the jungle to protect the orangutans. But man, this animation on the humans and the animals, quite wonderful stuff. There's a lot of weight to their movements, but it never feels like they were motion captured. They really blend extremely well into the environments that the 2D characters are put on. And you can tell through just the facial expressions, the personality of the orangutans, and like what's going through their minds, and when the poachers show up. And while there is a language barrier between Kintsugi and Michael, the way that they interact with one another is still very strong. You watch this movie for their bond because Kintsugi gets to have a temporary son to help and take care of, while Michael has a father figure who helps him grow as a person.
Their bond is the reason to see this movie, because I'm just always a fan of found family stories. And again, while pacing issues kind of drag this one down, once you actually get to the meat of the narrative, that's when this one is worth it.
That moment at the end when Kintsugi realizes that he sees the boat and knows that it's Michael's family, he has to choose between Michael staying there or letting him reunite with his family. And he knows deep down he can't keep Michael here. The sadness of Michael knowing that Kintsugi is never going to leave, because Kintsugi's role in life now is to protect the orangutans from the people who hunt for these animals to take for clothes, meat, zoos, and circus, and whatever. It's a very good movie. I think, even though there are three movies in this group that I think are just cream of the crop, I do like this movie and The Concierge, because at least with The Concierge, which is being brought over by Crunchyroll this year, it's not perfect story-wise. Honestly, its biggest hurdle is the fact that it's only 70 minutes long and it doesn't pace itself out to have a fully satisfying story. But I think The Concierge is still a very solid movie. Honestly, I would put Kintsugi's Kingdom and The Concierge above Kung Fu Panda 4, because while I think Kung Fu Panda 4 feels more like a movie, I still think Concierge and Kintsugi's Kingdom have stronger emotional cores. Which, to be fair, Mike Mitchell just wanted people to laugh when watching Kung Fu Panda 4. But as we said in our review of it, that loses the overall appeal of Kung Fu Panda. With here, at least with the Concierge, the drama between all the different characters is more on the forefront. And I like the dilemma when you realize that the concierge is about this woman who works at a department store, like old school, like the ones you would see on Miracle on 34th Street. The twist is the clientele are all animals, and not just animals, endangered animals or animals that were extinct. And I love the little vignette stories of our concierge helping these animals find a gift for someone that they cherish. Not all of them are of the same emotional weight, like that one jungle cat who wants to find a perfume for this girl he has a crush on. It's probably the more shallow one of the bunch, outside of that seal that was just the worst. But I loved the Japanese wolf and their relationship dilemma. Or the ferrets that were trying to find a gift for one another.
Were they the father and daughter?
Yeah, it was a genuinely sweet movie, but that's kind of the thing with this movie. The Concierge is all about vignette. It doesn't have a three-act story. Honestly, the major conflict of the story about this one guy who has no real character outside of, I gotta research and see if our main character is actually worth it.
The floor manager.
The one in the silver suit, not the other guy who was popping up all over the place, even inside burning, boiling soup kettles.
Because how?
I don't know, but that's the fun of this movie. It doesn't have the intensive amount of detail that a Studio MAPPA production would have, but Production IG and the team there went about giving the character designs a more fluid and cartoony flexibility to them. It's a lot of fun to watch these characters move. And it just shows how, like, anime can be this vibrant hodgepodge, accumulation of art styles, stories, and characters. This one maybe needed to be 90 minutes instead of 70, but who knows what exactly happened there with production, or they couldn't have the budget for 90 minutes.
Aside from whatever troubles they may or may not have had behind the scenes, had this thing been a full 90 minutes, it probably would have been a little better paced. Instead, it just kind of feels like a bunch of vignettes for majority of the runtime, and then a lot more of the dramatic conflict is kind of pushed off to like the last 20 minutes. And don't get me wrong, Like the individual vignettes are really nice. I think my favorite one is the father and daughter ferrets who are buying gifts, who happen to be going to the same store to buy their gifts. The setup and payoff for that, I think, is probably the strongest out of all of them. I just wish more were at that level. I would have enjoyed this more if they were all either met or exceeded the ferrets.
The small vignettes, they're inconsistent in quality of storytelling. I also really wish there was a bit more push for the woolly mammoth sculptor story because I loved the setup. I love the payoff, but everything in between just doesn't quite work out. Like the one with the perfume, like for that little cat boy. It's instantly solved. Well, not instantly, but it's solved because of a minor character that was introduced once, and then he just happens to find a perfume that the cat was looking for. It feels very unsatisfying. It's like, oh, I just pop up out of nowhere and then ta-da, have it. Granted, it's all about the distance people are willing to go for their loved ones. I get that. I love that about this movie. That's really the overarching theme of this movie about our connections and how we cherish the ones we are close to, and how ones who are more materialistic in focus are not. The moment at the end where the patisserie apprentice shows the mammoth this beautiful dessert to commemorate him and his late wife honestly got to me. Like, I thought that was a great little payoff. And how the movie did have a small theme of how humans are the worst and how we basically hunted everything down to extinction and how we keep doing that. But the through line needed to be stronger. I'm sure other Japanese animated films that are going to come out this year are going to be stronger narrative wise. But I just love the personality with the concierge and the more cartoony expressions and the fluid animation and appealing designs and how just so much personality is in the department store itself. And how you could just take a screenshot of a character and fully understand who they are as a person.
For that
Go ahead.
reason alone, I think this will do a lot better for people on multiple rewatches. They can go back and like comb through all the details of all the different animal designs. They can pay attention to all the details in the actual department store, go through each and every corner. That would be enough to give this like a comfortable recommendation.
Yeah, it's not the best movie of this bunch, but I still think it's a good movie. Like, all things considered, of all the movies I've seen this year, this is by far and away not going to be on the bottom or anything like that. It'll probably, I'm going to assume by the end of this year, depending on how the animation strike happens, this will probably be somewhere in the middle, but still a very good, like, 7 to 8 out of 10. But the big three, the big trio that I really wanted to talk about, and there was just no way in hell we were going to wait until May to talk about Robot Dreams. The last of the Oscar-nominated animated films that we needed to talk about. Let's just get this out of the way. Neon royally screwed up with not releasing this film sooner. I have no idea why they thought people would wait until May to see this. I understand you had other movies out. You had Perfect Days playing, and I very much enjoyed that movie, but we aren't going to get another animated movie until May. We're getting like four animated films in May. You're telling me you couldn't find a placement for it in April? Like, why 2 months? At least April, man. Because this is by far and away one of the best movies from last year, one of the best animated films from last year, one of the best animated films of the decade so far. It was just a sight to behold watching this movie when I saw it back in October at Animationist Film. because this was one of the first animated films early on in 2023 that got a lot of hype behind it during the festival circuit. And listen, I love film festival circuits to see what rises to the top and what gets left behind. But even the stuff that rises to the top isn't always going to be the best. But with this movie, I would argue it's one of the few animated films and one of the few festival circuit films that is full on worthy of the hype.
Agreed 1,000%. And the best thing about this movie is the fact that I don't want to say there's no dialogue. It's just there's very little spoken dialogue except for a couple yells and some yes. All of this movie is conveyed through body language, through facial expressions, and through music, particularly one needle drop that I'm sure other people would agree that there's no way they'll be able to listen to September by Earth, Wind, and Fire without immediately associating it with robot and dog.
Because this was one of the things that the director, Pablo Berger, talked about when I was at Animation's Film, where they fought hard and paid for the rights for the song. Because what Robot Dreams is all about is not just a lonely dog buys a robot friend. I think that's underselling the movie because the element of what is keeping this whole movie together. The driving force is how we as human beings, as people, hold on to friendships, old, new, long-term, short-term friendships. It's all about that. Just because it has a more pop art style, like more family-friendly visuals and such, or, simple, it's one of the most adult animated films out there. And one of the most, like, we're not going to talk down to our audience films that I've seen in recent years. It's like one of those movies where the animation and cinema crowd should be talking about, but are probably not going to go see.
That's the unfortunate truth. Because to be honest, not only do I not think the simple character designs hinder the film's emotional core, it only strengthens it.
I do think there is, you can define it as a film with no dialogue. Outside of the woohoos, wahas, and sounds, this isn't like the Triplets of Belleville where there is a little bit of dialogue thrown in. There's none here. And it just shows how great a movie can be when it's not hindered or reliant on a cast to carry the story. I love actors. I love the stories that they can pull together and take seriously, but you will get a story that's as emotionally powerful or even more so than most live action films. The story is more than just a friendship between a dog and a robot. It's about how over time we lose those strong friendships. And I kind of hate that right now we're in a bit of a like another media illiteracy storm where people are like, I can't like this movie. This character is unlikable. Because I'm worried when more people are going to see this movie, they're going to say Dog is a terrible character. When he's not terrible, man. He did his best to try and get back to Robot when he's stuck on the beach. You want to blame something? Blame the bureaucracy of, hey, my friend is stuck on the beach. I need to go out and get him. And New York is just saying, no, yes, he did move on, but that's what happens. Are you still friends with people from way in the beginning? I'm not friends with everyone I was friends with when I was young. I've had to make new ones as time goes on. And the movie's overall message is that's okay. It's going to hurt at first, but you are going to find those new bonds that make us and tie us all together.
At the same time, though, it's not like the memories disappear, which I think was the point of that dance sequence towards the end, just because you're no longer with either your best friend or the love of your life. Those memories will last a lifetime.
That's the thing. I have very fond memories of when I was like in elementary and middle school with the people I've been friends with. I'm not going to let go of those. And that's the thing about this movie. That's all that this movie is focusing on and talking about. And there's just something beautiful about that. It's a very human story, way more human than most award season and festival films, where they're just like, let us show the metaphorical and symbolic nature of humanity, and it comes off soulless, try hard, and not very good. You see a bunch of those kind of films every single year. But with Robot Dreams, like, it's funny how these three movies are way more human than the live action stuff at times. There's like a weird irony about that, and I just love Robot Dreams. The animation is wonderful. Especially since the studio that made it was more of a pop-up studio that shut down after production stopped. The simple designs lead to more expressive characters. You, again, since this film has no dialogue, it's reliant on the designs and the movements to portray the personality of these characters. You have the robot who's more wide-eyed and innocent. You have the punk rock monkeys. You have the kind of too cool for school love interest that the dog finds and then loses. And then you have the guy who finds robot in a junkyard, and how he puts him back together, makes him new with a few new upgrades, of course. How he's just kind of a very cool, eccentric guy, and how robot has also made a strong bond with him. I wish people were there when we saw this at animationist film, because the moment where you think robot is finally going to reunite with dog, it's like it's great. Everyone cheered. And then the moment you realize that it's just another thought from robot, everyone's heart was broken.
Yeah, I definitely felt the heartbreak in that scene.
Yeah, they're not going to get back together. Friendships and relationships are complicated. It's never easy to be like, hey, I'm back in your life. Is that a good or bad thing? And Robot sees it as like, I don't quite think it would be good for me to go back to Dog now that he's made a new friendship and bond with that other robot that he gets near the end of the movie. It's so nuanced for a film that looks so simple, but is not. Comes to show how sad a song September by Earth, Wind, and Fire is. It's one of those songs that is so good and so lively and universal that you forget that the song is really sad. If you look at it from a certain perspective, it's like the Girls Just Want to Have Fun song. The moment you realize slowing it down doesn't really make the song sadder because the song was already sad.
It just highlights how sad the lyrics actually are, and that's what makes it such a perfect needle drop for this movie.
It's just a great movie. I cannot wait for more people to see this movie, and I just hate that it's going to be until May. And then who knows how long it's going to take for the physical release to come out. I hope Criterion releases it on physical or something, because I need Neon Films to be more on physical instead of just showing up on streaming, because Neon's released a few streaming exclusives that I definitely want to hold in my hands, have in my collection. Like, what was that movie from 2020? Palm Springs?
Yes.
But here we're like with Robot Dreams, just a superb movie. Not just a superb animated film, a superb movie in general. It's like that moment when it hits is when you realize, oh, this is why this movie is so beloved from the festival circuit. And I talked to the director afterwards and I told him, I almost cried. I was saying, like, it's such a beautiful story, man. And he was such a nice guy. Believe in the hype for this one. Unlike a lot of films, just go in when you can, if you can. Just watch this movie however you can. I want to see more movies like this. It was just so great. I love it. It was, I think, my fourth favorite animated film from last year. I'll have to think about it when I look over my top 10 again.
It's either my second or third. Definitely right up there with Boy and the Heron and Across the Spider-Verse.
Yeah, there was a reason why this movie deserved the Oscar nomination. And like that was already a pretty stacked year for Oscar noms, especially for this animation category. And at one point, I was worried that it wasn't going to make it. And I was thinking, oh man, Neon screwed the release up for this movie. But thankfully, the Academy voted and nominated it. It just makes me happy that this movie actually was worth the hype and survived through the festival circuit instead of fizzling out near the end and such. Now, for this next movie, Chicken for Linda by Sebastian Lautenbach, who did 2017's The Girl Without Hands. Man, this is why I like covering festivals like this. This is why I'm always hyped for Annecy and why I'm always going to go and spend the money at animation as film. Like, Chicken for Linda is the golden goose of why foreign animation is so good, next to Sirocco and the Kingdom of the Winds. But we'll get to that one last. With Chicken for Linda, about a single mother, an argument and misunderstanding with her daughter, tries to make up with her, and the daughter wants a special dish, a chicken with peppers. And when I describe this movie, it sounds like a 90s family film. Mother and daughter bond, they chase after a chicken throughout the whole 90 minutes, and shenanigans ensue. This sounds like a 90s Disney family film. And not the good ones, like the really middling ones that they were making during the mid 90s, like early to mid 90s.
Like blank check.
Yeah, exactly that. Like, if you're thinking Disney was struggling now, oh, they've always had a tough time doing live action stuff that wasn't, their big money makers. And even their big money makers are now losing money for them. So it sounds ridiculous. Until you pull back on the premise and realize, yes, a lot of this movie is about chasing around a chicken and killing it to make this chicken and pepper dish. But it's not really about the chicken and pepper dish.
It's about what that dish represents, and who even came up with that dish.
The dish itself is the only memory that our lead character, Linda, has of her father. No other memories. All she can recollect is this one dish that her dad used to make. And yes, it gets over the top. It gets silly. There are musical numbers abound in this movie. But what really holds this movie up above so much else is the emotional core of memories, family, and what brings us together. The bond that our mother-daughter duo share with one another is so realistic, despite the more abstract art style, that it's amazing how this is all animated. When I think about this movie, when I compare it to our directors, who are really good at building up family dynamics. I'm talking about Mamoru Hosoda, Brad Bird,
Chris Sanders and Dean DuBois.
are all directors I think of who make really strong and likable and also very human characters. Yes, there are zany, cartoony animation antics, but they don't detract from the human core of the movie. And this movie gets pretty out there from the fact that they steal a chicken from a farm, run away from the police, get into a chase on the highway, and then just so happens to meet a delivery driver whose mom lives in the apartment complex that Linda and her mom live in. And then how the mom, Paulette, deals with her sister, who is more new age, kind of like high strung and serious, and how the movie dives into the memories of how Paulette's sister sees her and the relationships and details that come out from this story. Now, it does take place during a strike, and it was a very timely movie even before the writer and actor strike because of what was going on in France. But the story does only very much slightly connect to the strike that's happening in the movie.
It's window dressing, but at the same time, it also kind of explains why they had to go the extra mile to get the chicken, and then how all of that just kind of unravels into the whole town starting a little riot.
Yeah, going against the police and such. The musical sequences, which I think are probably the, like, and this is me nitpicking, the weakest part of the movie, are still super delightful. There's just not a lot of them. And I don't remember many of the lyrics, but I love the little moments where the animation goes abstract. It's a funny movie that's not so in your face with its comedy.
It's like that old school humor, but I don't want to say more sophisticated, but it's not the same kind of humor as like the Minions, for example.
It's more dialogue driven. And it has a few good physical comedy sequences. The stuff in the apartment with the old lady is so delightful. And I love that even the police officer that bonds with the Paulette's sister cannot get a hold of the police. Like, his own people are out of touch with him trying to contact them about all of this chaos. And the movie's animation is so beautiful. This is what Sebastian was known for with The Girl Without Hands. This very simple way of designing characters where they're all built on paint strokes that still have a very solid foundation to them, but you wouldn't say that they look like, it's hard to describe this. I mean, like, how they have consistent designs and movements, but they're more abstract human designs. Like, they represent humans and they all have different colors correlating to who they are as individuals. Like, Linda is yellow because her favorite color is yellow. The police are blue because obviously. And it does that thing that I love when someone does an abstract art style. When they're breathing, the lines get thinner and then thicker to represent the characters breathing in and out. Or, like, at night, everything's dark and the outlines turn into the color outlines of the characters just because there's no light in the shot, like when they're driving back to the apartment and such.
Those moments were cool. Also, there's a lot of line movement whenever there's a big chase sequence, like the one where they get into the truck of the delivery guy.
When the chicken is far away, it's just like a bunch of scribble that is like you can tell it's a chicken, but it also represents like the flustered, stressed out, freaked out vibe of the chicken. It's so creative in that way because we've seen that films do this a lot where they go surreal and out there with visuals that represent something. Kind of like that first sequence from Fantasia, where it's all the musical instruments in the sky.
Oh, yeah.
It's such a beautiful looking movie. It's so good, y'all. It was the last film I saw at Animation as Film. It won the Annecy Award. It won the Animation as Film Award alongside Robot Dreams. Like, for a film that, yeah, I think family could watch, even though there's mild cursing here and there. But its focus on family and connection really drives home how perfect of an animated film it is, because it uses animation as a medium of storytelling. It's not just, oh, we wanted to make a film for kids and family, so we made it animated. Someone said, I want to tell a story, and I want to use animation to tell the story in a particular way. You could not get away with doing half of the decisions here in live action. I'm sorry, live action has its limitations, and not that you couldn't get good performances or like a decent movie out of this, but it loses something by being live action, where animation, you just have more freedom.
More freedom and more control, because every decision, especially for a movie like this, which I'm going to assume was all hand drawn and very little, if any, use of CGI, you have to know exactly what you want for each frame, for each scene. And that's not easy to do, but when done well, the results kind of speak for themselves.
It's just, man, animation is just cool. It's just so cool. And I wish US studios were more willing to try stuff like this.
Same.
But, you know, they won't. They want their movie out when they want it out. And that means you can't experiment with stuff like this. Honestly, like, if they could find a way to make this work in CGI, I would love to see studios try something like this. Or the studios need to just buckle up and say, hey, you know what? If you need 4 years to make an animated film, do it. Chicken for Linda, just a wonderful movie. Easily my second favorite film of the year so far. And I'm sure that's not going to be topped. I mean, I hope that there's more to it. But this year, which is going to be strong and interesting, I feel like this and my favorite film of the year so far, Sirocco and the Kingdom of the Winds, are not going to be topped. I could see maybe Mars Express moving down from third to whatever, depending on how these other films go. But I think Chicken for Linda and Sirocco are going to stay in my top two for the year. But we'll have to see how that goes, because Sirocco, man, like that Al Pacino line from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, what a picture.
What a picture indeed.
It's a story about a author who is friends with this mom who drops her two kids off at her house. And what happens next is that the two kids find her books that she writes. She writes these big fantasy books of the Kingdom of the Wind, and all these stories take place in there. A toy that the titular Sirocco made somehow finds itself outside in the human world. And when he warps back to this fantasy world, the two young girls follow him into this wondrous fantasy world. And they turn into these cat girls because, you know, animation. And their goal is to then find the person the movie is named after, Sirocco, and get back to the real world, where along the way they find this frog mayor who is enamored with this beautiful bird opera singer, or just singer, because I don't think I would call it opera singing.
Me neither.
And of course, the amazing and mysterious Sirocco. And if you needed a stronger example of how great animation is and how powerful it can be as a medium of storytelling, show people this movie.
Basically, like my general thoughts on this movie echo that of Chicken for Linda, where it's like, this is what animation can be. And it's no coincidence that both these movies come from France because I think they're doing some of the most interesting things with the medium right now. I love the sort of classic setup of these kids find themselves entering into another world, a world that happens to be the world of their favorite fantasy books. And then we learn a bit more about the author through this world. And that just kind of makes the world come alive, and it just enriches the story even further.
So essentially, like, what makes this film so just fantastic is how it's a very straightforward movie. It's essentially an Alice in Wonderland, Wizard of Oz, The Cat Returns, Spirited Away style adventure, where our characters travel through this fantastical world. The movie then drops in the little story details that make this more powerful than just a whimsical roller coaster ride, which is, that's a fine way to make a movie, but the whimsy and magic here are more to carry the story of dealing with loss and, again, love and connection, which is kind of funny how all five of these movies that we're talking about all have that connection.
Yeah, it didn't quite hit me like that until zooming out and looking at all five films, but you're right.
Because the reason why the author made this book series is to commemorate her sister who died during some incident, and she did not want to let go of her memories of her, so she wrote this bird singer who as a representation of her, and just how, like, she is alone in the world, but then she finds connection with Sirocco, this powerful wizard who probably has my favorite design of the year of animated film characters this year. I love the blues and whites that permeate his design. I think it's a great magical character design because it's not just a typical wizard or witch look. It has a big old sun hat and a big flowing sleeves and robes. It's a very cool design for a character, and he's built up as this super imposing individual, but he's not really all that scary. He's powerful, but all he wants is connection because he feels alone in this world that the writer has crafted.
They make that pretty clear in the opening, where he creates these little toys to pretty much give him someone to talk to, someone who will provide entertainment.
It is like just a movie about dealing with that loss and how powerful emotions can be destructive but also beautiful, especially since Sirocco has to keep essentially his heart from causing more destruction. And he's worried about that, but that whole worry is just because he doesn't want to lose those people. It's definitely very much a French Ghibli vibe with how these characters are introduced. A lot of them are very memorable and funny, but they're mostly there to build out the world this time, and definitely in a very good way. Instead of just being like, we got to make up for the fact that our main characters aren't that interesting. The bond between the two sisters is very cute and reminds me of siblings that I grew up with, like during school, who are like sisters and whatnot. They act realistically, with the older one having to be responsible for the younger one, who's very much a brat, but reminds me of stuff like Lilo from Lilo and Stitch.
Yes, great comparison. Because before they enter the world, I wasn't exactly the biggest fan of Juliet, I think is the younger one. She's bratty. She is very impatient. I didn't realize at first that it was her birthday that they were celebrating. So that's why she was like, when can we have the cake? I want the cake. She gets better once they actually enter the world. And she's actually the first one who gets to meet Sirocco.
I love that interaction that they have where She's just like, oh no, don't kill me. Like, but also like, oh my God, it's Sirocco. This is amazing. I can't believe it's you. And Sirocco is just like, you're not scared of me? And she gets a little hyper and he's just like, okay, calm down. I love the character dynamics here. It's even like a little Princess Bride in a way,
Yeah.
or also very The Cat Returns also. Honestly, those two films kind of go hand in hand with this one. It would make for a fun triple feature.
Ooh, yeah.
And not just because two of the films have girls who turn into cats. And I love the little detail about broken people with the toy. The toy accidentally breaks. Then when they put him back together, he speaks nothing but gibberish. And I mean that quite literally. It's not someone having fun with the dialogue. It's not like a ghost story situation. It's literal gibberish that sometimes has tangential meaning behind what is going on in the film.
And other times it's grapes are in my armpits.
Like one of the few times where it actually matters is at the very end when the younger of the two daughters makes her wish. Well, it makes the first one, and then it makes the second one, where it's like the blue lightning quietly roams the sky or something like that. And it just kind of shows that, yes, they will see Sirocco again, either metaphorically, literally, or however. This movie is also so cool looking. I hope they put this out in theaters and give it a wide release. This needs to be seen on a huge screen. The abstract art, the flat color designs. And listen, flat doesn't always mean bad. It's just like they're not worried about shadow work and all these intricate details. Flat is just like very, it's one color and that's it. And that's not bad. It's the amazing clouds and sky that the filmmakers and animators craft look so good. And it's because they don't try to make everything look too busy.
It's very imaginative, these designs, like the crazy architecture, like you said, the skylines, the clouds.
The stacking block buildings where the frog people live.
Yes, all of that. It really does feel like fantasy book come to life.
It's such a unique and distinct fantasy world, too. I don't just see, oh, this is medieval Europe or whatever. It's Alice in Wonderland, if designed by the people who made the Yellow Submarine or Son of the White Mare.
Basically, yeah.
Like a more weird and vibrant look at a fantasy world. I love the some of my favorite sequences are when they're at the concert hall that's floating in the sky, and you get to see Sirocco looming over the clouds to be there for her performance. And the musical moment there, or there's like any time she sings, it's quite beautiful. I don't quite think I would call it throat singing, kind of like what you hear in Mongolian throat singers do, but it's very bare. There's no lyrics. It's just you vibe with it. You connect with it on a spiritual level.
Yeah, basically.
And the reveal of what Sirocco actually looks like from under all of the clothes and the very cool. I love how they portray magic in this world. It's very distinct from other shows and series and movies that use magic as a part of their world. The whole thing of how Sirocco dives into the underworld, or essentially purgatory or limbo, to find the singer's spirit to bring her back to life is poetic and beautiful. Just how he gives up literally everything to go down to bring her back up, and how it's just like Sirocco is essentially just a mask under all of the hair, the hat, the clothes. It's so beautiful, man. Like, this is one of the most unique looking movies ever. And we have been looking forward to this movie since 2020.
It's been that long.
Yeah, exactly. I remember we talked about Annecy with Ruben and how we found out that this movie was not even nowhere near done when we got the first teaser trailer for it. And it was kind of upsetting because it was like, pandemic times. Was I going to live or be able to live through this to see this movie? I mean, it's hyperbolic to say that, but
Course.
unsure times, very strange times. And it's one of those movies where it's so worth the wait. You cannot rush art. And even though I don't always agree with people like Shigeru Miyamoto saying like people will wait and cherish a game when we are done with making it. People aren't going to care about a game that's rushed out. Just like how with what's going on with animation in the US, it sounds like some films are apparently trying to get pushed out sooner, or they are shifting productions from one format to another to because not because, oh, we are actually ahead of schedule, or hey, this actually works out better as this than that, but because of Hollywood going through some just absolutely terrible, like, things right now that is all caused by the people running this circus.
As it usually does.
And yet everyone else is suffering the consequences of it. Like, again, gosh darn it, man. I loved Sirocco so much, and we can do this kind of thing in America, but we can't be doing stuff like DreamWorks outsourcing all of its animation to other places because they want to save a few dollars. I swear to God, man, Hollywood is going to implode on itself and collapse in to a black hole of just soul-crushing creative bankruptcy because they want to save a few dollars while everyone else in the world, while finding and struggling with their own challenges of getting these their films made, have these amazing, memorable experiences. Like, I will remember all five of these experiences, wherein I'm not probably going to remember a majority of them from the US. And it's not just Europe, Japan, and everywhere else are making better movies. It's because they are going out there to make these movies. Every film industry has the movie that they need to make a bunch of money.
Yep.
That's just what it's going to be. And like a show or it's just Hollywood is becoming less and less risk taking. And that's a big problem because we see what happened when filmmakers, especially in animation, are able to tell their stories, like with DreamWorks. Like Puss in Boots: The Last Wish is so freaking good that it's amazing that DreamWorks said, yeah, let's do this.
I hope everyone sees The Wild Robot, but I also hope that those people working on it are treated fairly, are given the time to, well, to cook.
Yeah. No, they're trying to get that done be fast if the indication of what DreamWorks is doing right now is because they don't want to have the animators have any things to hold back the strike, like to have any gambling power. They want the film done before the strike happens because then the animators won't have a bunch of films hanging over Hollywood because Hollywood can't afford that right now. So they need to just get back on track, start taking risks. We're at a point now where your money makers are not actually making you money. Now, granted, that's going to be different with stuff like the Minions and Despicable Me. That's probably going to make a lot of money. But you need to say, hey, we need to start making movies that everyone else is making, that everyone else is loving, more than the stuff that we are making. What is the thing holding us back? We're playing it too safe. Because how many films have we seen throughout these last 4 years where, yeah, there is just a lot of risk avoiding and just taking the safe route? Like, how much better would Lightyear and Strange World have been if they were able to take risks and do what they wanted to, or Wish wouldn't be such a disaster that happened behind the scenes if they went with the original weird and abstract idea that they could have gone with? Like, people are going to remember stuff like Sirocco and Chicken for Linda. They're going to keep watching those because of the risks and the creativity that was put up front.
We know that Chicken for Linda is getting, at the very least, a limited theatrical run in April. Do we have a date for Sirocco yet?
Sadly, we do not. And sadly, there's not one for Mars Express either. I don't know if Kintsugi's Kingdom or the Concierge are going to get theatrical releases here. I'm sure Kintsugi's Kingdom is probably going to, assumedly and hopefully, get picked up by like Shout Factory, or Crunchyroll does not let Aniplex decide how much people have to spend on the Concierge. Oh God, that's the worst thing about the Concierge. It's going to be held hostage by Aniplex and their absurd pricing.
Sadly.
But with Chicken for Linda, it's coming out April 5th. Go see it. If you have a theater that's playing it and G Kids actually gives it a wide release, go see it. Don't stop. Don't wait. Go see it. Don't be like that guy who said, I went to see Dune 26 times or whatever. Don't do that. That's not being supportive of the atmosphere of filmmaking. Go see other movies. Enrich yourself. Don't just see one type of movie, people. Sorry, it's frustrating these days where people are just going to go see something way too in their comfortability zone when they just take one tiny step outside of it. And they can find some amazing work. Because things like Sirocco and Chicken for Linda and Robot Dreams are incredible. And it's why I love animation. It's why I love movies. It's why I love this medium of an art form and a medium of storytelling.
The New York International Children's Film Festival, same thing with Annecy, same thing with Animation as Film. These are the film festivals that do the most to reaffirm everything that I love about the medium. I hope more theater owners are opening their doors to movies outside of the US because the more access that people have to these movies, my hope is that the more they will give these movies a chance.
It's like we saw what happened last year. Godzilla Minus One and The Boy and the Heron made so much money here in the States when nobody was showing up for the big tentpole stuff. Or they were just showing up for the smaller budget stuff. Like, even that rom-com that Glenn Powell and Sydney Sweeney were in was making so much money. You know what wasn't making money? Or at least not as much as they wanted to? The big safety net tentpole stuff. People are looking for something different. They want something different. They want something fresh and reinvigorating to why they go to the movies. It shouldn't have to be just, oh, you blink and you'll miss it kind of release, and then you have to wait however many months until it shows up on streaming or digital or on physical. Theaters and distributors and studio makers need to make these films more accessible, keep them in theaters longer, because all it takes is for a lot of good marketing and word of mouth to let these things happen. So
Exactly.
if you see any of these movies come out in theaters near you, go see them. I can't wait to talk more about these movies in the future. So we'll just have to see what's coming up for the world of animation. But next time, well, we got to talk about Megamind, y'all. It's going to happen. But we'll probably also talk about that Disney series that they collaborated with a bunch of artists from Africa with.
Oh, Iwaju? Yeah,
Yeah, Iwaju, so.
we have been hyping up this series for ever since that like one Investors Day call. That one has been on my most anticipated list for a while, and I can't wait to dive into that. But until next time, Cameron, where can everyone find you online?
You can find me on Twitter, Blue Sky, Instagram at Cam's Eye View. I also have my own website called camseyeview.biz, where I review animated films and shows from around the world called The Other Side of Animation. I also have a Patreon at patreon.com/camseyeview. That's where you can find me.
And you guys can find me on various social media sites at CaptainK42. You guys can check out my quick thoughts on letterboxd.com/CoachK42. And you can follow Renegade Pop Culture on Facebook and that place at Ren Pop Culture. You can also find us on YouTube, on Podchaser. Consider supporting our Patreon at patreon.com/RenegadePopCulture. Listen to all of our podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen. And last but not least, everything can be found at renegadepopculture.com. Need an escape? So do we. That'll do it for this episode of Renegade Animation. We will catch you guys later. Peace out.